My name is Colonel Jerry Cannon. I spent 25 years in the Air Force. I had 294 combat missions in Vietnam. 9 times I came home with battle damage to my airplane. Lost a lot of friends, had a lot of friends in POW camps, and had 5,000 hours of flying time, 3,000 of it in the old F-100, the Hun. The 105 they called the Thud, the 100 they call the Hun. So I volunteered all 3 times. People kept saying, "Why do you keep volunteering?" I said, "Well, sort of like you practice football for 10 years, and then the big game comes along, you want to get in it." Very, very tough on the families in the military. The first 10 years I was married, I was gone 50% of the time. I was in Turkey for 5 months with Bruce Baloff, who's a Logan retiree here now. We were there 5 months without my family. And I had 2 weeks to leave from Istanbul, Turkey, to Miami, pack up my family, move them to Tremont, and get back to Miami in time to fly to Vietnam, and all that in 2 weeks. So very difficult times for families. We had lots of divorces, gone all the time. So very tough times.
So, Colonel, did you grow up in the Tremont area?
I did. I grew up in Tremont, went to Bear River High School, came to Utah State to get 2 years of college before I could get into the Aviation Cadet Program. And halfway through that, they said, "We don't have enough cadets, so you don't need only high school." So I quit college, went to Aviation Cadet, and got my wings and my commission in June of 1955.
Is this something you had always thought about?
As a matter of fact, yes. My mother saved some of my grade school papers. Along the edge of my papers, I'd have a picture of a flying tiger with dot, dot, dots up to the Japanese zero and smoke coming out of him. Of course, I was like 8 years old or 8 or 9 years old during the Second World War. And so that was the thing that I always wanted to do, is be a fighter pilot.
Of course, the Vietnam War started. Did you feel like, well, this is, I'm going to end up in Vietnam?
Absolutely. That it was just, in my opinion, I thought we were doing the right thing. And again, I felt that's what I'd been training for 10 years. When 55 I started as a pilot, and this was 1965, and like I say, I'd been in Turkey for 5 months, and they needed another volunteer to fill a squadron. I was the first guy to put my hand up. And so it was just the right thing and the thing that I wanted to do, and that's why I kept volunteering to go back.
Of course, I don't know about 65, but as the war went on, it became more and more controversial at home. I don't know if you had any political views on the war before you went in, or if those changed.
I didn't have political views particularly, but after the war started, I felt upset with the attitude of the American public. I was the chief of airmanship at the Air Force Academy between my second and third tour, and I had a fellow that worked for me, a major. He went to Denver Airport to pick up his wife. He had his uniform on, and as he went down in a concourse there, a couple, 3 guys there, one of them slapped his hat off. So he looks to pick his hat up, and when he bends over to pick his hat up, one of the other guys shoved him and knocked him down, and then they proceed to tear his uniform up, his epaulets off, his ribbons off, and whatever you could do to get a hold of, rip the buttons off, and nobody helped him. Everybody just stood and watched, and that, to me, was my personal knowledge of that, but there were a lot of other things. Gestures, you know. I had a really, really bad attitude about the American public and their acceptance of the Vietnam War. You know, I didn't start it.
Right.
I was only doing what the government asked me to do, so why pound me?
Yeah. You know? And this was not atypical. These were experiences had by many returning veterans. What do you think that did to the veterans who came home?
You know, it made a lot of them quite bitter. You know, they say, you know, why? You know, it's tough. And when you got over to Vietnam and you saw how the Vietnamese people were brutalized, and I don't think that got out a whole lot, but when you saw it and heard about it, you just had the feeling that, man, we need to get those guys and get them stopped. You know, it's just tough.
or skipping ahead a little bit, I wanted to hear some of your experiences in Vietnam, but after you came home, you said you had a bad attitude toward the American public, you know, understandably. Did that change over time? How was your long-term homecoming?
Well, I stayed in the military. I wasn't like somebody that was drafted, went to Vietnam, and then came back and then tried to establish a civilian life. I was still in the military, and I came home after the first tour, and I'm still in the military, and then I go back again and come home and go back again. I thought it got a little better as it went on, as people saw and understood, I guess, more that the veteran himself should not be a target of their animosity. You know, they should be calling their congressman, or they should be doing whatever to let the government know, not the individual guy that was over there.
So you did three tours, you said?
Yes.
This was, tell me again, in the air, obviously.
Yes, I was there in 1965, December 65 until December 66. I was at Benoit Air Base. That was just north of Saigon. Second tour was in 68, and I was at Phu Cat, which was about halfway up country, if you want to do that. And then the third tour, I was at Ubon Ratchathani in Thailand. That was where the squadron was. And I was an F-4 squadron commander at Ubon. I was a commander of the 4th 33rd TAC Fighter Squadron.
Now, you say in the documentary, the Utah Vietnam War Stories, this is nothing but recollections of the experience by Vietnam War vets who have a Utah connection. You say in the documentary that some people assume you're going that fast in a jet that you maybe couldn't see things clearly on the ground. You say that's not the case.
That's not the case. I had an Army colonel in the back seat of the F-100 that's a two-seater. Usually they're just single seat, but each squadron would have a couple that had two seats. Anyway, I had an Army colonel back there, and we were going out in what you do call road recce. You're looking at what's going on. And he said, wow, you know, there's a truck. I can count the people around there. He just thought, doing 350, 400 miles an hour, that the ground would be a blur. It's absolutely not. Boy, you have a beautiful view of the ground. All you have to do is roll up on your wing and look out the side of the canopy, and you're looking right at it. You can be, you know, as low as you want, a couple hundred feet or whatever, and you can see people, you can see targets. It's a beautiful view, really, actually.
One of the worries, obviously, that you have in a plane is, and you're in enemy territory a lot, is getting shot down. You say you had friends that were in POW camps?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Most of the guys that ended up in the camps, or I guess I could say all the guys that end up in the POW camps, were shot down in North Vietnam. That's where the real shootdowns for captivity were. We had a few guys shot down in the South. In fact, one of the guys that came with me from Turkey, Lou Kanar, got shot down just north of Saigon. And he was down in the jungle. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there wasn't a rescue helicopter around any place, so an Army helicopter said, I'll pick him up, but I don't have a winch to let down to pick him up. If he can get to a clearing, I can pick him up. Well, no clearing. He was talking to the guy on the radio, and he said, if you can swim out on a river, I can let down close enough to the water. You can get a hold of the skid of the helicopter, and we can pull you up in. So Lou didn't want to spend the night out in the jungle, and high probability that they would come and grab him. So he swam out in this river to the helicopter, got a hold of the skid, reached up and got a hold of the bottom of the helicopter, and was pulling himself up when the two guys in the helicopter reached down, and he had a gun belt on. And so they each got a hold of his gun belt. They were pulling him in the helicopter when this belt that he had on broke. So he went from a lot of help to little or no help. So he goes back down, and apparently when he went back down, his chin hit the skid because he went down in the water, and he didn't come up right away. So one of the helicopter guys, he jumped in the water after him. He was just a gunner. He wasn't the rescue guy. But he jumps in the water after him, and he said he felt him one time with his foot, but he could never establish it again. And of course, the river's running, and slowly but still moving. And he never came up. Lou never came up. And they found him. Vietnamese guy found him a couple of weeks later when the body comes to the surface, and they found him, you know, down the river a couple of miles. And so that was right there in South Vietnam. But the majority of the shot down guys would be POWs, anyway, would be up in the north.
I know one of your concerns is you felt the U.S. government abandoned. Is that too strong a word? Abandoned some POWs?
No, absolutely not. That isn't even hard to cover it. I have some real hard feelings about the POW situation and how that went. Like I said, I had a couple of dozen of my old squadron mates who were shot down and captured. One of them, Dave Herdlicka, he was in Laos, and he had evaded up a hill and was talking to him on the radio, and he got up on top part of a hill, and a rescue helicopter was right there, the Jolly Green, and that's what they were trained for. They had the winch going down to him when the guys come out of the weeds and grabbed him. So we knew he was in good shape. He wasn't injured because he had been climbing up this hill talking to him, and he was in good shape, but they were 5 minutes too late to pick him up. They never admitted that they had him. And the North Vietnamese said, no, he was picked up in Laos. We don't have anything to do with that. And Dave Herdlicka was never heard of again. The important thing to do was get your name out so that people knew you were there. So if they knew you were there, then they had to justify you got home or you got sick and died or whatever. But they had to say what happened to you if your name got out. So that was really important.
So do you think there were U.S. airmen who were left behind, unaccounted for?
Absolutely. There's an excellent book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and it's written by Monica Jensen Stevenson and her husband. Let me read just one little paragraph. It says, this book is about a devastating American scandal. In Kiss the Boys Goodbye, two award-winning journalists provided startling evidence that the American government, right up to the highest echelon, knows and has always known that the American POWs were left behind at the end of the war. More amazingly, it has regularly obstructed the efforts of private citizens to discover the truth. That's an excellent book, and it just tear your heart out when you read it after all they went through.
You mentioned before we went on the air that there's a couple books you would recommend.
I would recommend that, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. There's another, and if you want to read the pilot's experience, it's called Fast Movers, Jet Pilots and the Vietnam Experience by John Darrell Sherwood. And that's interviews of thud pilots and in all different elements. Weasel guys, the ones that searched for the SAM sites, the guys that were the bombers. It's an absolutely excellent book if you're interested in how the pilots felt, what they had to do, the stress that they were under, et cetera. And that's called Fast Movers, Jet Pilots and the Vietnam Experience.
Okay. What do you think are lessons for today? What would you say to the new generation who maybe doesn't have a very vague recollection of, or no recollection of, the Vietnam era?
You know, I guess the only thing I would say would be that the veteran is the guy that needs the sympathy or the help and whatever. We had post-traumatic shock, which they didn't even identify back during the Vietnam War. The other day, the fellow that was the machine gunner, I've forgotten his name now, but anyway, he talked about alcoholism, drug use, and whatever, really heavy problems for the guys after the war. But there were other things, too. Agent Orange was what the government sprayed over there. And in a program called Ranch Hand, they sprayed 19.2 million gallons of defoliant and herbicides on 6 million acres of Vietnam. They'd spray this stuff along the edge of the rivers to kill the weeds and the leaves and stuff so that the guys couldn't get down in there and shoot at the boats as they were trying to get up and down the river. And so they didn't discover that it had problems. I ended up with cancer that I didn't even find out about it for a long time, and then the government finally acknowledged that there were so many of us that ended up with cancer that it can be a service-connected disability. Unfortunately, I had that, and this was years after. You know, I wasn't having mental problems or anything like that. Just bang, all of a sudden, wow, I've got cancer, and here's why. You know, the old ranch hand guys, they sprayed out of cargo airplanes, and they'd taxi out with these big, it was just like they spray crops. You'd see this stuff dripping out of their airplanes, and they'd take off and go. We'd taxi out behind them, and our airplanes are just like vacuum cleaners, you know. They're sucking up all of the fumes and whatnot as we taxi out behind these guys that are out spraying it. It was a bad, bad stuff. And later they discovered lots of birth defects in the Vietnamese people who were exposed to it. So, you know, there are all kinds of things that happen we find out later, like Agent Orange, and it's a big thing now.
Well, there are other experiences you'd like to tell us about from your time in Vietnam.
It was always raining over there, it seemed like. Boy, you've never seen a rain till you're over there. It splashes 6 inches high when it hits the ground, when you get one of them big old thunderstorms going by. So it was always tough weather flying. And, of course, that's what the Viet Cong used, night and bad weather, to attack whatever it was they were attacking, special forces camps or whatever. One night on alert, I flew five flights, in one night, supporting this one special forces camp that had been attacked. They used to take us out to the camps so we could get to know the half a dozen or dozen Americans that were there. There would be a dozen Americans there, each kind of a specialist. Then there'd be a couple of hundred Vietnamese that they'd have there all the time that were their army, so to speak. And so we could get to know these guys, know their voices, know what the buildings were. So if they got overrun, they could say, wow, well, the only thing we got left is the command post. Every other building inside the compound is a good target. And so we would know their voices, know that that was what was happening. And that's exactly what happened this one night when I flew five missions. We'd go fly, support these guys, go back, land. They'd load it up, new ordnance, as fast as they could. Bang, out we'd go again. Five times we went out there to help keep them from overrunning that one special forces camp. We went out to a target south of Saigon, down in what they just call the Delta. And when we first started the mission, the target was smoke, and then there was one bomb drop, and then there were a lot of people coming out the south. And when we would attack a target, you'd do it out of a wheel. And so one guy came in from the north, the next guy would come in from the east. I was coming in from the south. That way they never knew exactly where you were coming from, and they could track you. So I'm coming from the south, and the fact says, they're coming out the south. Get them. We've got them now. And I just had a feeling that there was something wrong, and I don't know what to call it other than maybe some inspiration or whatever it was, but I just didn't like it. So as I flew down the road, aimed right at them, I just rolled up on my wing, and then, as I described, you could look out at, and it was all women and children trying to drive their buffaloes out, you know, and their animals, trying to get them out of there because they knew their village was going to get hammered. Well, I didn't drop it, and then I called the FAC and said, wow, go check the coordinates. He comes back in a minute. He said, that's the coordinates. I said, well, get us another target. I don't like that one. So he goes back to 7th Air Force, which controls the targets. He comes back and said, no, that's the right target. We don't have another target. I said, well, sorry, but we're not going to drop on that. So we took our ordnance back home and landed, and I took some real heat. You know, how can you not take the target? We knew that was it. Confirmed it, etc. Boy, I took some real heat for a while. Then come to find out that the Vietnamese local district commander, they call him, was getting protection money out of the people in the villages to not have their villages attacked. And these guys either couldn't afford to or wouldn't pay So he put him as a target. So come to find out, it really wasn't a good target. It was a setup by somebody else. And that was one of the things that upset you over there, was the corruption that went on. So much stuff was stolen and diverted, and that makes you upset. But again, that wasn't the average person. That wasn't the normal Vietnamese. It was some guy in a position, and we find out that a lot of people get power or get in a position where they can, and they abuse it. And that's what that guy was doing.
A lot of veterans, of course, this is a stereotype, which I think is probably true of World War II veteran, didn't talk much about their experiences when they came home. A lot of Vietnam vets didn't either. I wonder what your experience was.
Well, I didn't talk to it other than to fellow fighter pilots. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was still in the service, in squadrons. And so we talked about what we did, what happened, what worked well, what didn't work well. But the people on the outside, you just didn't feel like saying a whole lot. What can you say, you know? We lost the war. We ended up 58,000 Americans, I think, was the number, got killed. Lots and lots wounded. Lots of people with post-traumatic stress or cancer or whatever it was, and we didn't end up with anything. So you look back at it and you say, did we waste all those lives? Did we waste all that money? Did we waste all that time invested in something that didn't turn out? So it makes you really gun-shy to try to do something like that again, you know? But then you see things happening around the world now, and the temptation is to try and help them, you know? The bad guys always seem to have plenty of weapons, and the good guys can't protect themselves because the bad guys only hit them sporadically, you know? So the bad guys can come in with 50 guys, and you got only 25 trying to defend, and then they hit you, and then they leave. They don't come back again for a while. So it's just difficult. Terrorist stuff like that is really, really hard to do anything about it. And you see it going on all around the world, Africa particularly, what's going on over there, and you want to help, but how do you help?
Do you feel a kinship with the veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yeah, I do. You know, I know how they are. They're away from their families. One of the advantages that these guys have now, they can call home at night and tell them. When I was in Vietnam, it took a letter 10 days to get home. So my wife hears on the radio that two or three fighters got shot down today. 10 days before she gets a letter from me saying, hey, I'm doing good. How are you doing? You know, and by the time she gets a letter I've written, two or three more have been shot down. So it was very, very difficult for the families during the Vietnam War. And so this is one advantage that they have, and I think it's great that they can get information back home quickly of how they're doing. And it's just great, I think, the way that people are supporting them, population is supporting them, the assistance they get, the help that they get in trying to alleviate the problems that are generated because of this kind of thing.
Finally, what is your advice to returning veterans today?
Well, you know, if they're getting out, why, I guess the thing that I would say would be, obviously, get back in school or get some kind of a trade that would give you some stability in your life. Don't just, I don't know, sit around and wait for somebody to do it for you. Go out there and find out what you want to do and pursue it with all your heart and accomplish something. Make yourself able to take care of yourself and your family and support the country.
Very good. We've been talking with Colonel Gerald Cannon. He's a Vietnam War veteran, flew three tours in Vietnam, and he's part of Utah Vietnam War Stories on Channel 7 KUED. Colonel, thanks.
Thanks.
Appreciate you coming in.
Appreciate it being here. Have a chance to vent a few of the things that I've wanted to say.
Very good. Very good.
So I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I hope it's been beneficial to those that have been listening.